Dixon versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. These matters are being recorded. No other recordings are permitted. Please state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. And as soon as you're ready, counsel, no rush. Go ahead and set yourself up. And you can begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Gerald Dixon. The Minnesota and United States constitutions provide defendants with the right to counsel. However, defendants may also choose to waive that right and represent themselves. But before permitting a defendant to do so, the district court has a duty. It must obtain, on the record, a voluntary and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel, and before even obtaining that waiver, it must advise the defendant of several things, including the nature of the charges, the range of allowable punishments, that there may be mitigating circumstances, and all the other facts necessary to an understanding of the consequences of that waiver. The district court here never advised Mr. Dixon of any of those as required by the rule, and it never actually obtained any valid waiver from Mr. Dixon on the record. The other facts and circumstances surrounding this case also do not show that Mr. Dixon ever validly waived his right to counsel. So for those reasons, we would ask you to reverse the convictions in these cases and grant Mr. Dixon new trials.
I don't disagree with anything that you just said, counsel. I think the thing that is implied in all of the briefs and the record is that Mr. Dixon is not a stranger to the Scott County District Court, that he has many cases before probably all of the judges down there. And I wonder to what extent that experience with Mr. Dixon and his repeated refusal to be represented by counsel during those district court proceedings, to what extent should we consider that familiarity with Mr. Dixon?
Two parts to that. Excuse me. First, I am not aware of any case that, obviously your history with the criminal justice system is a factor that's considered, but I am not aware of any case where a reviewing court has said that that factor standing alone is ever sufficient to have a valid waiver of counsel. I would not say that he necessarily refused counsel. He invoked his right to represent himself in this case. And as far as we're looking at in Scott County, and we're maybe getting a little bit into part of my motion that was deferred to this panel, in my opinion, for case 1091, it starts on, I believe, April 26th through the May 3rd and 4th hearing. And then in 1093, we're going to look to, at that point on 511, they're all in front of Judge Wilton. That hearing on May 4th is the first time that Judge Wilton is on this case. And that's the first time he says, I'm going to sign an order and appoint standby counsel. But he never obtains the waiver of counsel. There is nothing in the record that shows that he actually validly waived his counsel at any time prior. I know there is an order that was signed. In reviewing this case, I actually noticed he writes there's a date for waiver of counsel. He never actually checks that box. He does check a box appointing standby counsel. But again, there's nothing that we have that shows that that was a valid waiver of counsel.
And correct me if I'm wrong, and my recollection, just on my recollection of the record, I don't recall seeing an advisory as to what the purpose of standby counsel or the scope of the duties of standby counsel would be either. Is that correct?
There is a little bit of language in that order that appoints it, but it doesn't.
It's not on the record.
It's not on the record. He's never given any of those advisories. Even if we were to consider anything else that, you know, his familiarity with the Scott County system, he still needs to waive counsel every time he has a new case. In every prosecution, he has that right to counsel, and he's never waived it in these two cases. I understand that he appeared in front of many judges. Mr. Dixon seemed to have a pretty good rapport with Judge Wilton. There's nothing in the record that suggested that Mr. Dixon is going to refuse to sign a waiver, or if they said, look, Mr. Dixon, I need to tell you this, and then you either need to sign this paper, we need to do it on the record. There's no indication that he's refusing to do that. He invoked his right to counsel, but again, that just is the starting factor for, okay, now we need to do the waiver of counsel. I think some of the other factors in this case, and it's a problem with the state's argument, is there's a temporal aspect for when we're looking at all the other facts and circumstances as well. The time you want to look at is at the time of the waiver. That's what the Supreme Court says in, I think it's pronounced Krejci, K-R-E-J-C-I, what it says in Worthy, in that at that time that they waived counsel, they had been sufficiently advised, they knew enough to have it be a valid waiver. Because you're looking for, is there enough on the record where if the district court didn't do its duty, that information was still communicated. So when the state is saying, well, Mr. Dixon was advised he would need to act as a trial attorney would, that's happening months later. That's happening way after they've appointed the standby counsel and maybe not accepted a waiver. I don't think they did. And it's the same with what the role of standby counsel is. That's happening later. When all of that needs to happen is at the time of the waiver. And there's just not enough supporting facts or other circumstances to show that Mr. Dixon's waiver of counsel was valid. I will just mention briefly, I said that history of the criminal justice system has never been standing alone. Neither has standby counsel, which I acknowledge Mr. Dixon had. I do not know of any case where that standing alone has ever been sufficient. I do not know a case where there are both of them, where you have standby and a history of the criminal justice system, and a court has said that is enough. There's always something more. There's always a discussion with your previous attorneys. There's always an advisement. There's always learning this information at some point. And that just never happens in this case. So unless the panel has any further questions.
I do not. All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. Here today, I'll simply address the lawyer-raised issues, unless the court has any question on anything else. But the issues that are pro se raised have been fully briefed. I can answer questions on them, but otherwise, I'll simply defer to the brief on those and respond to the right to counsel issue that's been raised in the two briefs that we're here on today.
So, Mr. Zettler, could you just start by telling us what the state's position on when was the date of the waiver that you're taking the position is valid? Is it the April 12th, 21 date?
That's when he appeared in the first file in 4001, okay, which is the domestic file that ultimately gets dismissed. That's when he appears in district court with a public defender, discharges the public defender. So that happened in file 4001, which is not one of the two fourth-degree assault cases that we have appealed here, or that have been appealed in this case. So all the district court judges were very well aware of the history of this case. All the district court judges were...
Say this case, what do you mean?
There's five cases. Yep. Okay, let me be clear. Of Mr. Dixon and his cases and his accumulating cases. So from the very beginning when he came in on that very first case, he was a challenge. This was during COVID, by the way.
And how do we assess that on appeal? Because we have no record of it.
So you do.
I have no record. We have no record as to whether the waiver that was obtained at that point in time complied with Rule 5.
So you have transcripts from that, which are in the file now. You have the.
And are they properly on appeal or before us? Is it a record in these two cases?
So in my view, it's the appellant's burden to provide the record of where the error is. And if all the district court is referring to a specific date as to where the waiver happened, and you don't order the transcripts from that date, you should order the transcripts from that date, shouldn't you? Especially when all of these cases are intermingled and referring to each other and referring back to a particular date.
So, okay, let's just give me a timeline here. The waiver of counsel that you claim occurred is April 12th. Right?
The hearing is April 12th,
and
correct.
And when is he charged in these two files?
So I tried to put as much detail as I could in my statement of facts. to give kind of a timeline.
I think he's charged on April 25th. So you're saying that the waiver of counsel for charges that originated on April 25th and 26th occurred 2 weeks ahead before then?
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
And is there any authority from any jurisdiction that would support a conclusion that a waiver of counsel that occurs 2 weeks before charges would be valid in subsequent cases?
Right, and it sounds insane when you put it that way. And the way that...
Well, I mean, that's what we have here, so...
Right, and so when you look at the brief from appellant, at his very first hearing, he had no lawyer, and he just moved on, and the district court judge said, I know you don't want a lawyer. If that's the way it went down, that's a problem. But that's not the way it went down. This was mid-flight. This was six cases accumulating over a fairly short duration during COVID. So the district court judges were doing their best to deal with a very difficult and violent defendant. So,
I think what you're saying is that when this first appearance in front of Judge Wilton on May 4th was in regard to that first case and the two assaults one of the assaults that's before us now. But I think your position is because the hearing was on all of those matters, it incorporated the waiver he had already provided in the 4001 case?
Yes.
And your claim, so you can waive counsel in two ways. One is expressly. You're not claiming that there was an express waiver of counsel. You're claiming it's based on the totality of circumstances.
Both. He expressly waived counsel in 4001. I don't want a lawyer.
But you're not claiming he expressly waived counsel in the two files that we're here on today.
I'm saying that was incorporated by Judge Wilton. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk about whether you're also claiming that it's the totality of circumstances.
Yes.
Okay. So when Judge Wilton says to Mr. Dixon, I don't know what the range of consequences are for this matter, go talk to a lawyer about it, why would that circumstance indicate that that there's been a waiver of counsel on that particular issue?
Where is that said?
It's during the first appearance.
Okay.
I understand it. At the first appearance in the second assault case.
Okay. So when I'm looking at what I would argue is that based on the facts and circumstances in this case, I mean, essentially, if the court doesn't find the express waiver carries forward, and you're looking at, was this a knowing and intelligent waiver of his right to counsel? Based on the facts, essentially a totality of the facts analysis, right? You look at the background experience and conduct of the accused. So it isn't just the single hearing. It is the accumulation of hearings up to that point. You look to, including, frankly, the Scott County cases that 4001, where he had a lawyer and he was specifically waived that lawyer.
And what does he need to know to make a knowing and voluntary, intelligent decision to waive counsel? Doesn't he need to know what the range of possible consequences are?
He does know what the range of possible consequences are. He has the complaint. He's been given the complaint. He reads the complaint. He's been advised of what those are. He then subsequently litigates all of those.
Where's that in the record? I mean, that he had read the complaint and understands the charges and the potential range of consequences. I mean, the judge says, which, you know, is not great, I don't know what the range of consequences are, go talk to your lawyer about it. I mean, it should be on the complaint.
So I'm not doubting that that's said somewhere, but I can tell the court without a doubt that Mr. Dixon understood the consequences of these offenses, if nothing else, as time went on and he litigated these. He engaged in extensive pretrial litigation over specifically the consequences of these. He kept trying to reduce it to a misdemeanor from the felony. So, I mean, this is not someone who didn't understand the consequences of these charges or his decision to represent himself.
Mr. Settler, if I may, looking at, you know, these considerations we're supposed to consider as far as the validity of a waiver, doesn't it really just come down to the participation of standby counsel and prior experience with the familiarity of the criminal justice system? At the end of the day, aren't those really the only two things that weigh in your favor? If we look at participation of counsel prior, it's in other criminal justice proceedings, right?
That's correct.
And so that comes down to Mr. Donovan's point is, do we have any case law that says just those two things is enough? Because really we have just those two things here, right?
But we don't have anything that says it's not enough. Because what you're looking at ultimately is, was this fair? Did he know what he was doing? It was fair. He did know what he was doing. He knew what he was doing because in the prior case, he was told what about his right to counsel and had a lawyer. He was told because he has the criminal history, extensive criminal history. He's a career offender. We know that he never asked for a lawyer, and in fact, every single time said, I don't want a lawyer.
He didn't say that. He said, I don't want him.
I want to represent myself. He's standby counsel, right? I only want standby counsel. And he verified repeatedly, he's only standby counsel. I'm my own lawyer. Mr. Dixon wanted to represent himself, period. And it's an automatic reversal. He has a constitutional right to represent himself. We have to give him that, however difficult it may be. There is no question that this highly experienced and litigious criminal defendant knew what he was doing. And knew what he was doing in the first trial, and knew what he was doing in the second trial, and knew what he was doing in the third trial. Not once did he say, oh, gee, I need a lawyer. I just got convicted. This isn't going well. I should have a lawyer for my next trial. He didn't say that. He had another trial. After that one, he still didn't say that. Didn't go too well. I just got convicted again. I should get a lawyer. No. He proceeded again, representing himself, because that's what he wanted to do. And we have to. It's not we want to. We have to let him represent himself as long as it's knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And nothing indicates in these cases that it wasn't knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And as to the idea that you can't look at a waiver in another case and bring it into this case, isn't that exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at a defendant's criminal history? You're looking at, do they know what they're doing based on their history? And based on his history, yes, he knows what he's doing.
I didn't see any cases that refer generally to a defendant's criminal history in the consideration of whether a waiver in a particular case is valid.
It's cited as a factor in cases. And I cite those cases in my brief.
And is there a case that relies on that factor as a dispositive?
There's not a case that says that alone is the determinative factor. And so in all of these cases, as soon as you look at the experience of the accused, as soon as you're in that realm, it's highly fact-specific. And there is nothing that says you can't look at what he did after to determine whether it was voluntary. And so the temporal issue that's raised by appellant, similar to how as this court looks at intent or premeditation, you look at what did the defendant do before, during, and after to determine what was their state of mind. The same applies to determining whether he knew what he was doing in any given trial. And so you can look at all three trials in this case, and you should look at all three trials in this case to see, did he know what he was doing? Was it knowing, voluntary, and intelligent? Not did he do a good job. Not whether he was convicted, not whether a lawyer would have done a better job for him, but did he know what he was doing and was it voluntary? And it was. I would also point out, finally, that this was a very active standby counsel who consulted with Mr. Dixon closely throughout the entire litigation in all cases. And was that's clearly on the record as well. Do the court have any other questions?
I'll ask a question about one of the arguments in the supplemental brief. Mr. Dixon makes an argument that he was not, that he requested a lesser included instruction for fifth degree assault on both of those files. It was not given. My read of the case law is that there is zero discretion for the district court to decline to give those lesser includeds, and so why is what's the state's response to that particular issue?
So my response here is the same I gave to the district court, which is there's no discretion as long as it's met three factors. It has to be lesser included, which it is. But then it has to be the next two. There has to be a reasonable basis to acquit on the higher and a reasonable basis to convict on the lower. And both of those fail in both of the cases. There's no reasonable basis to acquit on the higher offense, and there was no basis to convict of fifth-degree assault. In fact, that was the basis Judge Wilton found no probable cause of fifth-degree assault and dismissed one of the cases. So the argument that there's a reasonable basis to convict is contrary to that. So that's why. With that, I would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Donovan?
Just want to make three quick points on rebuttal. Number one, Mr. Dixon saying, I want to represent myself, is not waiving his right to counsel. Again, that's just the invocation of the right to self-representation, necessitating a waiver of counsel done by the district court. Secondly, Mr. Zettler was saying he's learning.
You don't have a record to know what happened on April 12th, 2021 in the 4001 file, right? We don't have
the
transcript.
There is not a record in these cases. I know that the counsel for the state mentioned that there were transcripts that are in that file. I know that there was one cited in their brief. That was why part of my motion to strike. In preparing for this case, I've noticed that there are more transcripts that have been filed in that case. I've not been served with them. I'm going to ask you not to look at anything in that case. That said, if you want to deny my motion, I would still win because A, he never waived his right to counsel in these cases, and B, if you look at that record on April 12th in 4001, they don't actually do a waiver of counsel then either. He just discharges his public defender, and that's what's noted. There's a document that the state cites, order for release. There's a note on there. It says discharge public defender. He still never waives counsel, even if you want to go in the records of those cases. And finally, there was talking on he's learning the punishment as it goes. He's learning these things as it goes. It's the time of the waiver. That's what Worthy is talking about. That's what Krejci is talking about. At the time, they were aware of the consequences.
Well, he'd been convicted, according to the Spriegel notice, three times of fourth-degree assault before the charges in this case, these cases, right?
That I don't know his criminal history. I won't dispute that if it says it on there. But it is the consequences of waiving the right to counsel. That's what he needs to know. He needs to know all those consequences. I would say that when you get to sentencing, it actually shows he is a little confused because it's a consecutive sentence. And Mr. Dixon is there saying, I'll take 14 months, but with the 22, not on top of the 22. So even then, he's still a little confused about things. He's not understanding, wait, this is consecutive. Why am I not getting jail credit on both files? He's even then, when he's being sentenced, he still doesn't seem to entirely understand the possible punishments. So if the panel has no further questions, we would again just ask that you reverse these.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. All right, thank you very much, counsel, for your helpful submissions and argument today, and we will take the matter under advisement. It's been submitted, and you will issue our opinion within the statutory time period.